Welcome to In the Weeds with Nicole Asquith, exploring the way culture shapes our relationship to the natural world. Hello, everyone. Before we get started, I wanted to let you know that I've taken on a new project, and so my episodes will be coming out less often. I'm aiming at one episode a month, though the timing may not be exact. I have some really interesting topics coming up. It just may take me a little bit longer. My guest today, William Bryant Logan, is a certified arborist. He's the founder and president of Urban Arborists, a Brooklyn-based tree company, as well as a longtime faculty member at the New York Botanical Garden and the author of four books, Sproutlands, Oak, Air, and Dirt. I've been wanting to talk to Bill Logan for some time, at least since I prepared my episode on oak trees with Doug Tallamy. Logan's book, Oak, is a great complement to Tallamy's because it gives us the long history of humans' relationship to these trees, and it shows how important oaks were to human survival and the development of civilization. It's really quite a stunning story. But in this episode, we talk about his more recent book, Sproutlands, about two techniques for pruning and culling wood from trees that go back thousands of years, pollarding and coppicing. Now, this may sound terribly specific, even arcane, but you'd be wrong about that, since it turns out that pollarding and coppicing are a kind of secret door to the past, to thousands of years during which humans interacted with trees in a way which was beneficial to both. And it's also a conduit for learning about trees themselves. This is truly one of my favorite interviews to date, and I hope you enjoy it as much as I do. So I thought maybe we could start where you do in your book, which is with the miraculous regenerative property of trees. You know, there's so much, as we are learning, that we don't understand about what trees are capable of. And one of the things that your book really brings to the surface is the amazing capacity they have to remake themselves, to thrive, to come back to life. They have this ability to resurrect themselves, really. And so you start with a particular example. You start with the example of this willow tree in New York City that was famous because of an essay from E.B. White. I was wondering if you would mind telling that story for my listeners, because it's such a compelling story.
Great. I'd love to. It was a great thing for us because we felt privileged to be able to take care of this great willow tree when we heard that it was the willow tree that he wrote about in This Is New York. It's an essay he wrote shortly after the Second World War. And he talked about how threadbare the willow was even then, but how important it was to him. It was in his backyard, basically, in New York City. He lived on the East Side when people could still live on the East Side and have a backyard. And he ended the essay by saying he thought that as long as that tree was alive, New York would be fine, in spite of the possibility of atomic destruction and all the other things he was worried about. So we got hired to take care of that tree many years after E.B. White's death. And it was really, really terrible. I mean, it had hardly any living branches on it at all. But we recommended, in fact, that they remove it. And then they told us, no, this is the tree that E.B. White wrote about. We can't remove it. So we preserved it for about 5 or 6 years. A while, we were able to keep it. But then it just started breaking apart. We had to take it down. Still had a few living branches on it, so we cut those, and we took two or three of them back with us and stuck them in the dirt in our yard in Brooklyn and didn't think any more of it until sometime later in the fall, I looked out and I saw something that looked like it was like, I said, what? I thought we had planted all the willow oaks. I saw this thing that looked like a willow oak in it. I went out. It wasn't a willow oak. It was the sticks of willow that we'd stuck in the ground. They had sprouted. And we said, that's good. We didn't think they'd make it through the winter. We did, but willows being willows, we figured maybe they will. So it has. And now I was looking at it this morning because we were having to raise up its crown so that we could get things out from underneath it. That thing that not many years ago was about three feet tall, is now about 40 to 45 feet tall, three-stem willow tree, and as happy as a clam. And we thought it was dead as a doornail. And, you know, it just looking at it said, look, trees are capable of such extraordinary things because it could barely keep any branches alive. But the problem wasn't the vitality of the tree, but the connection between those few branches and the roots that existed in this old trunk was not good. So we actually did the tree a favor when we cut it off and put it right in the ground because it could regenerate new roots. So to us, that was a miracle. And now we spread it all around. Since White said that as long as that tree is alive, New York will be fine, we've been cutting it every spring. We cut the stems and we kind of surreptitiously plant them all over New York in the hope that New York will be fine.
It would be nice to think that White could know that that was happening. So are willows unusual that way? I mean, how typical is it that a tree can just sprout new roots like that?
Willows are really probably the best, almost the best at it of any of the temperate trees. And one of the reasons that when you're going down a stream that has one willow on it, you will often find 10, 20, 30, 50, or several hundred willows, is that they simply will drop branches. You know, wind comes up, it drops a living stem into the creek. It goes down the creek until it settles somewhere, and there it roots. So they're really, really good at it. But other plants are too. If you want to find out the ones that are best, the best thing to do is to go to state forestry websites and find all the trees that the state foresters are railing against. And calling horrible trees. We can't get rid of them. They're really awful. Black locust is another. Black locust was a very important tree to everyone before the industrial age because its wood is so good for putting against the ground. It doesn't decay or decays very slowly when it's placed in the ground. So you can make fence posts out of it. You can make the sills for your house out of it. It was a very, very useful plant and prized by people before the industrial age. And now it's an enemy because it's hard to get rid of it. And there's numbers of species like that. Some species are less good sprouters. A lot of maples, for example, are not very good sprouters. Oaks are pretty good sprouters. Redwoods turn out to be champion sprouters. Lindens are also very good sprouters and, like redwoods, have an organ at their base that allows them to sprout from the base for as long as they live, which in the case of a redwood could be several thousand years.
So can you explain in layman's language what happens when you take a branch like that and you stick it in the ground? How is it that it's capable of generating new roots? Because that's not normally what a branch does, right?
Well, you can often, with young branches of any tree, and often a little bit of rooting hormone or something to encourage it, get that to happen. And many, many trees can do it. The reason is that my friend, the tropical botanist Francis Allais, has a wonderful way of thinking of it. I once had the privilege of giving a talk right after him at a conference in Spain. And he began by saying, the human body has 68 organs. None of them work very well. We die very young. Trees have only three organs, root, stem, leaf. That's all. They live much longer than we do. And sometimes when they appear to have died, they return again. And it's because of that simplicity of organization. In theory, every stem is capable of sprouting roots. Many will not unless you encourage them. Willows and others that are excellent sprouters will often have their small stems sprout, be able to sprout because they're simply the cambium layer underneath the bark can cause wood to get thicker and create new circulation system. It can create new branches. It can create new leaves. It can basically do anything, including make roots. So sometimes, for example, when we're taking care of old trees that have developed a big hollow in them, like elms do this a lot, and they've got a great big hollow and water gathers in that hollow and there's decay. So there's this kind of nice compost that the tree has made inside itself. And you will find that the cambium layer has caused roots to emerge from some of the other tissues of the tree and go right into that compost. So the tree roots into itself. So it's very different from us. They're kind of colonial organisms to start with, and individuality in them is kind of an afterthought.
Mm. I like the idea that the simplicity of organs is part of what gives it this facility, you know, this ability to mutate and to be much more adaptive to its environment. So the two central terms in your book, Sproutlands, are pollarding and coppicing. So let's attack those. Can you just give us a definition of what each of those are?
Yeah, there are two different ways to take advantage of the sprouting properties of trees. People and trees live together by means of these forms of pruning for thousands of years. People learned that if you would cut back a tree, not all trees, but most of them would resprout. And there were two ways you could cut them. One is you could cut them very near the base, and let them resprout from there. And that was called coppicing. It comes from an old French word. So in Europe, it was called coppicing. It's called bulga in Japanese. And if you cut them up higher, say it, you leave a trunk 6 feet tall and cut above that 6 foot, then you will do what is called pollarding. And that allows the sprouting to occur higher up. Typically, people would do pollarding if the tree were in a pasture that had a lot of herbivores in it. Because the herbivores, typically, if they reach the new sprouts, they will just chew them right down. So if you coppice and don't keep the herbivores out, your coppice tends not to do very well because they keep getting chewed down and they run out of energy and they don't do well. So if you do coppicing, when there are animals, you have to fence them out. And there are ways to do that. Even people used to use the old tops of trees they were removing in order to make fencing to keep the animals out. So you can do one or the other. But the point in both of them is to encourage the resprouting, which then allows you to have all of this wood for all kinds of different uses, and sometimes fruits and other things as well.
Yeah. So it turns out, I mean, one of the things that's fascinating is it turns out that this is a practice that was used all over the world for millennia, which is really such an interesting history. So it seems like what inspired you in part down this path was a project that you had that involved pollarding for the Met. Am I right about that?
Yeah. I ended up writing the book because I was kind of trying to keep myself honest. My company had been hired to pollard these new trees in front of the Metropolitan Museum of Art. We actually selected them and pollarded them. We pollarded them for 2 years in the nursery before we brought them to the Met, and now we've been working on them ever since. They asked me, and when they called up to see if we were interested in being one of the people considered to do this, if I'd ever done this before, and I promptly said yes. And I have, because I teach pruning in New York Botanical Garden, and we have done experimental pollarding. But I didn't feel like I'd done nearly enough of it. So I decided that I would have to go and find out about it. And I started doing that, and it was shocking in this country how few people I could find who could tell me anything reliable at all. And many of them would frankly say, we're not quite sure how this is supposed to be done. We're doing our best. But then I started to go to Europe, and I thought, well, this will be fun, and I'm going to enjoy seeing these trees. But I'll have to ask them why, you know, the trees must live a much shorter time because you're constantly cutting them, right? You're wounding them, harming them. And one of the things that most shocked me was one of the first trees I visited, or the first sites I visited in England, was the Western Bird Arboretum. It turns out that the Western Bird Arboretum is where it is because of a linden, or they, as they call them, lime tree, that had been coppiced there for a very long time. And it's still sprouting. And when I saw it, it had just been cut the year before, maybe 2 years before. And there were all of these standing 30-foot tall stems that were all kind of gathered together in a phalanx with all of these stumps around them. And it was very, very beautiful to look at. And I was reading about it, and they believe that that single coppice tree is approximately 2,000 years old. So my thought that I were damaging these and they were going to live a much shorter time, I was like, what? And it turns out to be generally true that, you know, you can damage a tree. You certainly can. And a lot of what people call pollarding or coppicing is nothing but topping. It is very bad for trees. But the relationship that was developed between the people who knew how to do this and trees allowed them to have multi-generational relationships. The people would go through many generations. The trees often just one.
So I'm curious about the distinction you made just there between topping and pollarding, because it makes me think of, I'm part of this committee that's working on a tree ordinance where I live right now, which, you know, it's actually a very interesting process. You wind down all of these sort of tributaries that you weren't expecting to. Pollarding came up sort of casually in conversation. Somebody referred to it as a kind of mutilation of trees. And I think that is a common modern perception, because people see pollarded trees. They look funny to us because we're not used to it. And topping, as I know, can be damaging. Can you explain what the distinction is there?
The difference is largely, well, partly it's in the type of tree. Someone who starts pollarding or coppicing your maple trees, I wouldn't be so sure about that. But otherwise, it's largely a question of how large the cuts you're making, on what size wood you're making. Typically, when you're making the cuts on wood, well, we usually, our rule of thumb when we're doing ornamental pollarding is 2 inches or less. But in pollarding that was practiced by people for millennia, sometimes it would be up to 10 or 12 inches. But the point is not simply to wantonly whack everything off the tree, but to do this in a way that respects the tree's ability to respond. So typically you'd start on very small stems, and as the stems become larger, you may be pruning back to larger stems, but the trees become used to doing this. So it's a way of working with trees, not of simply whacking them. And what frequently happens, what is often called pollarding now, is by people who they said, oh, well, this is just pollarding, when they whack 18, 20-inch branches off a tree and say, well, that's okay, it'll be fine. Well, trees are very resilient, so the likelihood is it won't die immediately, but it may very well send it into decline. The bigger a stem is, the harder it is for the tree to close that wound without decay or other problems setting in. So you want to be judicious when you're doing it. And it's also an art. You really have to study what a tree looks like. We've learned this in our work at the Met, because you could do this in ways that are pretty ugly, but they don't have to be. And when I've looked at really fine pollarding around the world, there's a lot of sensitivity to the forms we're making and trying to think from the tree's point of view, what's this form I'm making doing for the tree? Is this going to help it present its leaves to the sun, which is why it branches to begin with, right? So when I'm adjusting things, I may adjust them in a way that helps, doesn't hurt that that process.
I'm going to go take a look at your trees at the Met after we do this interview.
No, I think they're coming out pretty well. But, you know, they're obviously, for me, it's a beginner. We often, when we were starting it, I often wanted to have someone from the Neolithic beside me and say, excuse me, sir, what should I be doing here now? Because they would certainly have been able to tell.
They must have. I love this idea of like almost a dance between the humans and the trees, right? It sounds like you must need a real sensitivity to the trees, to the particular formations of the trees and what's happening with it. I like this idea of sort of sensitivity. Let's talk about a specific example. So one of the chapters in your book talks about a wood in the Basque Country in Spain, where the trees were pollarded for different uses, but particularly for wood used in building ships. So you talk about how the Basque were the champion shipbuilders of the Renaissance. Correct me if I'm wrong about this.
That's right.
And, you know, it's wonderful, the descriptions in your book of the types of wood, the shapes that were required for these ships that were built, and how they had to cut the trees and respond to the trees in order to grow this wood, essentially.
Yeah. And it's, you know, again, it was a multi-generational process, because very often wood that you started wouldn't be ready until your children were grown. So you would have to pass on to them the responsibility of pruning, and they would look for the shapes that they needed for different parts of a ship. There's a lot of kind of contention that they bent things in this way. And certainly later, when there was a lot of steam work, it was possible to bend wood in the way you wanted. But in earlier times, it was usually just a question of training. They would select the stems that they wanted. They would often remove stems that looked like they wouldn't be useful for the purposes they had. Sometimes they would leave two or three principal stems on a given oak tree. Most of this was oak wood they were using. And then they would pollard that repeatedly as that wood grew until the pieces that they wanted for a ship were of the size that they needed. And then they would harvest the whole tree. So that was a process of harvesting in the end. But then in the meantime, for between 30 and 60 years, they would very often be cutting back branches, that big branch that they were allowing to become the, say, knee of the ship, they would let grow, but they would allow things to grow out of the end of it, and they would harvest those. And as they were harvesting them, then they could go for charcoal, they could go for all of the other things that that wood might be used for. Also, as they sprouted back, they were nice young stems that would tend to be very good producers of acorns. So those forests were also an important place for grazing pigs, for making Spanish ham, which is famous around the world. So it's so good. And it's one of the reasons it's so good is it's often finished on acorns. So people would bring their pigs to this place. For one, I'm thinking is the forest of Sacana from 100 miles away to be finished on their acorns. And then they would take them, and you needed to work them green. And the people would work very fast to get the entire ship together while it was still green. And I was working with some people who were imitating them and making a boat. And they finished about 5 years ago now. And it took them much longer because they were going much slower. And they found that when they were using green wood, they had trouble finding the wood to start with. When they found it, they would sometimes let it sit for too long. And of course, as greenwood dries, it shifts and changes. And so their nice square pieces would suddenly be rhomboids and would suddenly be right out of what they, the shape they were supposed to be in. So they learned that part of the trick of making these ships was to have a large crew and make them quickly.
That's interesting.
And, you know, they made out of them boats that were at the time the best boats built in the world.
And you write about a ship that was recovered and they were able to identify that the wood had come from that particular forest. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they used the Canadians. They found that the Basques had been cod fishermen and whalers. And they whaled quite a lot over near current Newfoundland. And this ship, the remains of this ship were found. It apparently dragged its anchor in a big storm and sank in fairly shallow water near this little island, near a place called Red Bay. And the Canadian archaeologists raised every single piece of wood, measured it all precisely, looked at all the tool marks in it, and then put it back. And out of it, they reconstructed the ship. And so the Basque guys who decided that they would rebuild this ship took advantage of all of the details that had been provided them by these archaeologists and were able to rebuild it exactly.
Wow, that's amazing. So let's talk a little bit about coppicing as well. So can you explain, so when you coppice, you cut relatively low to the ground. How low exactly?
Varies with the plant.
Okay.
Some plants like it lower, some plants like it higher. And I don't want to say which is which because I'll probably remember wrong. But for example, when I was seeing a whole lot of coppiced hazel in England, it would usually be cut very near the base, but not exactly to the base. And it depends in part on what the tree likes to do. If it likes to root sprout, if it likes to sprout from the butt, from the very base of the tree, or if it likes to sprout from the lower stems. And this is one thing that people who lived with trees learned pretty quick. Because when they cut something down, they would see where it resprouted from. And so you can see at a glance what it's doing. And then over millennia, they developed ways of saying, I want this one this low, this one this low. So always very near the base, but sometimes right to the base, particularly if it was a root sprouter. There's some very good pictures of this. The great English scholar of this was a man named Oliver Rackham. And in Rackham's books, he has this common illustration where he shows different kinds of pollards, some lower, some higher. But the point is to decide from the plant what's going to give it the best opportunity to resprout and then let it. And typically, coppice will be allowed to go back for at least 10 years and sometimes as many as 20, but not much more than 20 because then you're cutting on too large wood.
And one of the reasons that coppicing was used was because of the way that it grows back, right? Because you end up with these straighter stems, is that right?
Well, coppicing was easiest to do because you were cutting to the base, and particularly in the days when people didn't have as good tools, back in the days of stone axes, for example. I mean, the Neolithic stone axe was the reason that people could begin to do this. It was good enough to make the cuts, but it was kind of an unwieldy tool. So if you could cut near the base, it was a heck of a lot easier for you to do it than it was if you had to reach up 6 feet each one. The tools we have now, you can do it, of course, in an instant, but they couldn't. Coppiced wood gives you a longer stem quicker. Sometimes that mattered to people. Sometimes it didn't because they were doing everything from making poles for weaving fencing or sometimes wattles. And sometimes they used a lot of the coppice in the oldest coppice that they know or that they've recovered in the lowlands in England was used to make basically little bridges across a fens. So you would get longer stems quicker than you would with pollarding, though you could with pollards too. And also pollarding would typically have more of the structure of branching, whereas coppicing has, it's almost like it is. It's making a multi-stem plant. In fact, one way to make a multi-stem plant is to coppice it. You know, if you want to have a true multi-stem amelanchier, is to cut it low and let it sprout back.
So just a general question I feel like that might help us understand is, particularly in a time when presumably woodland was more available, why is it that they were not just cutting down trees? Well, they were cutting trees, but why would they not have just clear cut a section of forest and used the wood that way? Why was there this regenerative, what's the word that I'm looking for? Sustainable, there you go. Popular word nowadays.
Beyond sustainable.
Why was this the sustainable method used as opposed to what we see nowadays, which is more of a exploitative approach to gathering wood?
Well, the cynical people would say it was because it was very hard for them to clear cut. But I think the fact was that people learned very early that if you treated a tree in this way, you would get wood to use back pretty darn quickly because you were working on the basis of an existing root system and sometimes an existing root and trunk system, which meant that every time you did it, the tree had more roots. So even though there would be some root death when you did that, some retrenchment of roots, you got a very good root system going. And so you could get things back much, much faster than if you were just cutting what they called maiden wood. That is wood that hadn't ever been cut before. So I think that was a large part of their motive. And also, they were looking at entire landscapes. You know, they didn't just live off the wood, but what lived in the wood and all of the different animals and plants, some of which were of direct use to them, and others of which they simply prized and loved. I mean, the great kind of country boy poet of England, I think the great poets of modern England, was a man named John Clare. And Clare was a country boy. And Clare knew birds better than anybody because he lived with them and had grown up with them. And all his friends, that's what they did for fun, was they went out and looked at the birds. So one of the things that happens in a coppice woodland, partly because when you cut a coppice woodland, or pollard for that matter, you don't cut them all at the same time. You cut them in sections. So if you have like 150 acres of coppice woodland, you might have 10 acres newly cut, 10 acres cut the year before, 10 the year before, out to 15 or 20 years. So you have some almost mature forest there. And right next to it, you have wood that is brand new where you've taken everything down. So totally new plants grow. The seed bank that has been waiting dormant while your stuff grew up to 20 years, you cut it down to the base. All of a sudden, it's all exposed to the sun. All the sun-loving plants come up. So sometimes in some coppice woodlands, you go from having like 35 or 40 understory plants in the fully closed forest, and all of a sudden you have 150 when you make the cut. And some of those were directly useful to people as food or as tea or as medicine. Others they knew would simply attract creatures that they were interested in. And this was done for so long that there are, for example, butterflies in England and around Europe that specialize in coppice landscapes. One of their life stages lives on part of the coppice landscape, and their other life stage lives on another. So I think that's a lot of it, is they were not just getting wood. We think, oh, we're going to have a forest, and we'll cut it all down, and we'll get all the wood. But we weren't just getting wood. It was a whole complex of things, and it was a way of life. I mean, one of the things about all this is it's a way of living. And you see, I met extraordinary people, two of them, who said almost the same thing, although one of them was a Basque, and the other was a Norwegian. They were both very old men. And I remember this one guy who was pollarding ash in Laiza, and he would then wait till it was 1 year old, cut it again, and feed it to his sheep in the winter. And he told me all about the tasks he did and how hard it was. And I said, God, you must, he was sitting in front of his fire and they had a television set and all that. And I said, you must be glad to be done with that. He looked at me like I'd gone nuts. And he said, no, I love that life. It suited me. If I had the strength, I would be there right now. And basically, the same thing was said to me by this old Norwegian. You know, I saw videos of him from like 15 years before doing this special kind of piling of wood, drying stems, doing all of the things that they did. And I commented on how hard the work was. And he said, yeah, but I loved it. Mm. You know, so it was a way of life. And, you know, You could overstate that and romanticize it, but it's also a fact. You know, it was hard work, so it was tough. And the older you get, the harder it gets because your joints hurt and all these things happen. At the same time, it gives you a sense that you're doing something that you ought to be doing. And the Norwegian woman who was my guide to the Norwegian pollarding and is probably the great student of it who's ever lived, Ingvild Osta, said, you know, I'm a scientist, and I would ask these people, why are you doing this? And they would look at me and say, I think it's what God wants me to do, because it was like entering into this whole complex system of life, that this was a way that people could be a part of. Mm. Yeah, pretty cool.
Very cool. It's, I mean, it feels so distant from most of our realities, you know, at least in the more, you know, technologically advanced parts of the world now. It's hard not to romanticize on a certain level. The other thing that comes up a couple times in your book too is I think we have this notion that people who lived in these ways that were much more labor intensive, that all they did was work all the time. But that's a misconception. So I remember in your chapter on the California Indians in particular, you talk about how it seems like a lot of the basket weaving, for instance, you know, the collecting of food, and we should talk about their fire coppicing as well, how hard it is. But you say, we think now that they probably didn't work as many hours as we imagine, that they also had time for play. You know, there were also all of these celebrations and festivals that were an important part of their lives.
They had a lot of time to play. And that's another thing I found in traveling around the world, was that these lives were basically not insecure lives. They were quite secure. And, you know, students of the tribal peoples of California and their use of oak and many other things, because in fire coppicing, that is in burning instead of cutting, they would get all kinds of resprout. And not only that, they would sometimes, if you wanted to have a snack and you were burning a field, you would just wander over the field afterwards. And if at the right time of year, you could get several entire days worth of meals of nice roasted grasshopper. So they ate a whole wide variety of things. And they were able to live very lightly on the land, do very little harm, and work less hard than we do. David Bainbridge, who studied the cultures for a long time there, said he thought that people could gather in 2 to 3 weeks enough to keep them alive for 2 to 3 years.
That's incredible.
So, of course, because they used such a diversity of materials, if they had one failure, they weren't out of luck, because there were other things, a lot of other things that they were eating. And they knew the landscape very well. And I found that everywhere I went around the world. I found it in Japan. I found it in Norway. I found it in Spain. I found it in the eastern woodlands, and I found it in California. You know, I'm sure if I'd gone elsewhere, I would have found it elsewhere too. It was about this kind of living as a part of a larger world rather than just kind of extracting one or two things.
Right. With respect to the California Indians, I just want to find the statistic that you include. You write that it is now estimated that the Indians burned annually an average of 7,000 to 18,000 square miles, or about 6 to 16% of the state. So that's every year, which is a staggering figure.
Yeah, it is. And that's not me. That's, I can't remember their names off the top of my head, but there's been a great book produced by a couple of anthropologists from UC Berkeley about this. And that's their conclusion. They had the great good fortune. You know, there's a lot of thought that to some extent, the older anthropologists there were kind of exploiting those cultures. But at the same time, you know, Kroeber and his colleagues wanted to find out everything they could about those people. So they left a lot of information that has been able to be mined by people since then to figure out exactly how people actually lived in those days. And and you can see it. And I think I quote some of them. When the Spaniards first appeared on the coast or were going up, you know, riding from Mexico up north, they would frequently see smoke on the horizon, and they were shocked by it. And they often, because they were carrying both their draft animals and their horses they were riding and pack animals as well, they were saying, but wait a minute, our animals have nothing to eat, because they would go into an area that had just been burned. But of course, the people who had just burned it didn't have any draft animals or pack animals or anything of the kind. And they were basically renewing their landscape. And it wasn't their primary goal. I don't think anyone's ever suggested to prevent wildfires, but certainly their doing it had the side effect of making wildfires much less likely to occur. And did they sometimes get out of hand? I'll bet they probably did. But because they were doing it very frequently, they couldn't get as terribly out of hand as they get now when we had this terrible Smokey the Bear. I mean, I have nothing against, well, yes, I do. I mean, I think the sale of Smokey the Bear, I mean, his being careful with fire is obviously important, but the idea that we should not burn was a really bad idea. And it wasn't until 2018 that the law prohibiting it was repealed. Not until 2018. That's not even 10 years ago.
Well, now they're doing these controlled burns to try to prevent these large forest fires. But I heard the other day that it's very difficult for them to actually do them for all sorts of reasons, from lack of resources to, you can imagine the conditions have to be just so, particularly in a state that is increasingly populated, for that to be done. Do you feel like there's a lesson to be learned? I mean, are there ways in which what the California Indian tribes did can be a lesson that we can apply today in a very, very different world?
Yeah, I mean, one of my main motives for writing this once I found it out was to, because it suddenly occurred to me when I found out that the trees lived a longer, not a shorter time when you did this. I said, but wait a minute, we keep trying to think up how we can go into the future in a way that is more what we call sustainable. I said, as though we'd never done it. Up until the industrial age, we did it between the ice age and the industrial age. In some cultures, we did it continuously. So it can be done. So I think in part, though, doing exactly that may not be the thing we do to look at the world as a whole and our place in that world. One of the main things we can do is stop thinking that we are something different from nature. We are not. We are creatures in nature, and we can either be responsible or not. And we've been terribly irresponsible basically for 200 or 300 years. So we need to find ways to be responsible again. And one of the things in looking at these people is looking at how they were able to live on the land in a way that was not only sustainable for the land, but it also sustained human beings by giving them a sense of what their place was and how they could live with things in a way that was profitable for all. I mean, that's one of the interesting things about this, is that it produced all kinds of things, both things that were immediately useful for food or for medicine, but also cultural things. I mean, the Japanese coppice woodlands, which were largely all over, at least the main island of Japan, were the foundation of classical Japanese poetry, because the animals and the plants and the things discussed in those poems are basically those that lived in the coppice woodlands. So whole cultures kind of grew around that kind of interaction.
It's so interesting that these coppice woodlands were more diverse than, you know, so-called virgin woodlands, you know, that they actually created more plants and more habitat for animals. So much the opposite of the effect of many of our interactions with the natural world now.
Yeah, and I must say that, I mean, it's kind of, get on my high horse, but I think to some extent, although the kind of celebration of nature that began with people like von Humboldt in the late 18th or 19th century were very important and very good, but at the same time, they allowed for this kind of separation between people and nature that I think has been horribly destructive. So that, you know, on the one hand, we're talking about maintaining some pristine national park, whereas, you know, 20 miles away, we're whacking the living daylights out of entire forests. And there's some disconnect there. And I think that, you know, it does involve reimagination of how we should be living in the world, and probably can't be done on any large scale. But seeing people like agroforestry people or other people who are starting in small ways to do this, I think that's where it will start. And it may use completely different things than we think. I mean, it may use some of our technological capabilities, like to do solar. Maybe we'll find local solar, and maybe we'll find ways to like bring that into our, you know, in the old days, people would bring it in by simply siting things so that the sun got to them in the winter. But we can multiply the sun's power now. So just ways in which we can live together with all of the natural forces around us and be a responsible part of it.
Well, I do wonder also about the carbon capture aspect of pollarding and coppicing, because obviously if you allow the root systems to stay intact, that's where so much of the carbon capture happens with trees. It seems like it could have real repercussions. I also, earlier you mentioned the post von Humboldt notion of nature that we have. I feel like one of the effects of reading your book to me is I realize how much I am a child of the romantics in my own notions of nature, how much I, you know, grew up idolizing a notion of wilderness, right? A notion of the wild that I think in my case was influenced by reading a lot of 19th century poets and novelists.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, I'm a relatively new homeowner and new gardener in the last 7 years or so, and I've learned a lot in that time. And I think that my notions of nature in a funny way influence that. I'm kind of not a very effective suburban gardener, right? Because there's a part of me that just wants things to be a little bit wild. And so I found your book really interesting because it challenged that notion that there is this clear-cut distinction between human interference and wilderness. In fact, what you propose is a world in which it's a much more rich dynamic between the two. So I have to think about how that's going to apply to my own garden. But
Well, that's part of it is just having fun with it because, you know, plants are great. I mean, they come back almost on, you know, my pruning students, I've been teaching pruning for more than 20 years at New York Botanical Garden. And my students often come into the class afraid of all the bad things they're going to do. And I say, it's okay. We're going to learn what the right thing to do is. And even if you miss, even if you make a mistake, you'll probably be okay. The plants will forgive you. But what we're trying to do is to learn how to really talk with them, you know, because if you do something to a tree, you wait to see its answer. And sometimes it answers you exactly as you expect, and sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it'll sprout crazily where you don't think it should. It'll go in a direction you didn't want it to go. It'll sprout from the base, or occasionally it won't even sprout at all. And you'll go, what did I do? And that's just one example of all the ways in which we can enter into. And when it's flower growing, you know, there's all kinds of different ways of doing that. And propagating is another thing that's so much fun for gardeners, you know, is to figure out how can I make more of these? What's the best time to do it? Why am I doing it this way, not that way? And learning by experiment is partly why I have so much fun when I talk to like garden clubs, because there are people who've been out there who've done it.
Right.
And that makes it fun.
Yeah, absolutely. I wanted to touch a little bit on some of the kind of larger philosophical questions that come out of your book, also in relation to this ability that trees have to resurrect themselves to be, let's see if I can find the phrase that you have. You write, potentially every tree is immortal. So maybe explain that to us first. How is that true?
The main thing that kills a tree is not the fact that it's run out of energy, but that it can no longer get what it needs to make new energy from the roots into the tops. And that's often because over time, a trunk, for example, will have become decayed or acquired organisms that are preventing the circulation from bringing water from the roots. So if you can somehow short-circuit that, the tree can, in theory, keep sprouting and keep living. I mean, there is a shrub in Tasmania that they found that is at least 46,000 years old. And they know because the existing plant is right next to fossils of the plant and the DNA is identical in both of them. You look at redwoods that have sprouted, redwoods sprout very well from the base. So you'll often see, like a mushrooms, you'll see a fairy ring of redwoods growing around where a previous redwood was. If you go where I grew up in California, that was one of my favorite redwoods groves, was a place called Big Basin. And there's a tree meant to be 2,000, maybe 2,200 years old now. And you can often tell when you see an older redwood by the shape of its root system, if it was once part of a fairy ring. And the shape of that 2,000-year-old tree's root system tells you it was certainly part of a fairy ring. So it was a sprout from a previous redwood. And how far back do those go? Mm. And they're genetically identical. And then you look at things that are clonal groves, like the clonal groves of aspens in Utah, and those are able to resprout and resprout and resprout again. So in essence, there's no reason that they couldn't live indefinitely. And they don't, you know, people often say, what's the lifespan? When I'm an arborist, people say, what's the lifespan of this tree? And I say, well, it's a little hard to say because although we know about how long these are likely to live under cultivation, it's different than you might think because we have definite lifespans, trees don't.
In your chapter, Evermore, you kind of philosophize a little bit. You're writing about these clonal trees where we don't know how old they are. You mentioned this one grove where the estimates are between 10,000 and 1 million years old.
Right, that's the aspen grove.
So you write, if you don't mind, I'll just read a passage. So you write, immortality and individuality don't mix. The Christian, or for that matter, the Buddhist assertion about eternal life become less credible the more you think that immortality is a property of individuals. A little later, you write, even while we live, we are hardly isolate individuals. 90% of our cells are not the human genome, but others, chiefly bacteria. And you go on to explain the various ways in which the idea of human individuality is problematic. And then you write, the Christian's Gospel of John is clear on this point. A person is only really alive, wrote John, if he or she is a branch attached to the growing vine. God may prune the branch to make it bear more fruit, but as long as it is attached to the parent vine, it will prosper. If it is severed, it withers and it is thrown into the fire. Like the reiterating growth on a tree's trunk and branches, the vine branch is both an individual and a member of a community. A green shoot shall spring from the shoot of Jesse, wrote Isaiah. Abide in me, wrote John, conveying the assertion of Jesus that he was the vine through whom the branches lived. The tree and the vine both teach us about the shimmering. It is not true that there are no individuals, and it is not true that there are. When a branch is pruned, it sprouts back. Even when a tree appears dead, it may arise again from the roots, and it can apparently do so forevermore. It is the same and not the same. It is the shimmering. That is what the sprouts teach. Immortality is not a matter of holding on, but of letting go.
Yeah. Yeah, because you see those clonal groves, right? And is that the same tree or not? Well, no, it's not the same tree, but it is the same tree. This is, for me, is partly derived from my love of my favorite part of Darwin's Voyage of the Beagle, is when he arrives at somewhere on the coast of Latin America, and he starts to look at these organisms called sea pens, which are a kind of shallow water creature. And they're all originating from the same base, but they have individual things they do. They eat individually. I think they reproduce individually, but they're all connected to one another. And he has this wonderful passage where he says something to the effect of, well, may one be moved to ask, what is an individual? And it's really, to me, that's always resonated with me. And seeing how often and how many religious traditions, they use plants to analogize what immortality is or what eternal life is or how you reach eternity from time. And I just find that fascinating. And it's particularly in trees, you see how it's the same, but it isn't the same. It's both. And that's what I meant by shimmering. You know, you think you see it, and then it changes. And then you think you see it again, and then it changes. It's the same, but it's not the same. And it's not reducible. It's not reducible to one idea or another. It's both. And I think one of the great, for me, lessons of plants is that they teach us about this ability to exist in the world in a way that is fundamentally connected to everything around us. Mm.
I love the idea that they challenge our notion of individuality too. I mean, some of the practices that we've been talking about also seem to do that. I imagine that, you know, if you live and work and play in a coppiced wood, your notion of what I is would be very different than it is living in the modern world.
Yeah, maybe so. And you see it sometimes in, there's a great poet and dance critic named Edmund Denby. And one of Denby's poems, I've always loved the end of, it's a sonnet, and it ends, and in this bright confusion, we are bound, like anything, to everything around. Just beautiful. And he was a dance critic, and you could see that. I knew a number of dancers when I was younger in New York, and you could see in their dance performances that that was partly what they were achieving, was this sense of being both individuals and members of a company. And you know, there are many, many ways in which that happens. I think it probably happens in military things. It probably happens in camping. It happens, and we all experience that. It even happens at Thanksgiving, right? And usually when something is happy and we're happy to remember it, it's because it was a place where our individuality was subsumed under something that was as or more real.
Yeah, absolutely. Can we talk just a tiny bit about oaks? I haven't reread your book recently, but I loved your book on oaks as well. I did an interview with Doug Tallamy about his book on oaks. My personal interests lean often towards literature and towards history and things like that too. And what was so lovely about your book on oaks is that it brought all of that together. Could you maybe give us a little soundbite to encourage my readers to go and read your book on oaks as well?
Maybe that I should say, I mean, the oak is, to my mind, one of the prime examples we have of what both Lynn Margulis and Lynn Boddy, two great people who study small, tiny organisms, microscopic organisms, call the holobiont. And their assertion is, well, Lynn Margulis' assertion was, and they called her an idiot until they realized she was right, that there are no individuals, that the eukaryotic cell is a symbiosis of prokaryotic cells. So all the cells out of which all we so-called higher animals are made is a community. And I think, to my mind, one of the great things about oaks is they are such an extraordinary example of a holobiont, because not only the microbial life that is living and circulating inside them and in their roots and at their base, but also the birds and the insects and the other animals, everything that is living with an oak means that when you look at an oak, you can't say, you know, this is the individual and it has all these things on it. What the two Lynns assert is no. We have to look at the individual as the whole thing, the holobiont, that creature that is the center of a community. So that's what one of the things I most love about oaks. And also that we as human beings participated in that for a very, very, very long time.
Yeah. We owe so much to trees, don't we?
Yeah. They just found the oldest tree, they think, the oldest root system they've ever found, a fossilized root system, about 10 miles from me at our house upstate in the town quarry in Cairo, New York. They found a 375 million year old root system.
Wow.
So we are children compared to trees.
Coming up, I'm working on a series on horses, those animals who played such a dramatic role in human history. In the meantime, if you have any suggestions or thoughts you would like to share, send me an email. That's at askwith@gmail.com. Also, if you would like to support the podcast, please tell your friends to listen as well and write a positive review wherever you listen. It would be much appreciated. Thanks.